on issues, etc., American evangelicalism and pietism, an interesting conversation. I'm looking forward to it. Dr. Martin Noland of the Concordia Historical Institute is going to join us here in Studio A to talk about pietism. We'll get a primer on what this long-standing, kind of like a roach in the church, hard to kill, very hard to kill. We'll also be reviewing Pastor Joel Osteen's sermon from this past Sunday's broadcast of his program. That's coming up tomorrow on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Here in the third hour, we spend about 40 minutes with Uwe Simonetto. And we're going to be talking about something, of course, that is in the mind of many today. Today marks the 42nd anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas, 42 years ago today. And according to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in the Nation section, conspiracy theories live on. We'll talk a little bit about some of those theories, about Uwe's own theory, perhaps, about what is behind the Kennedy assassination. He covered not only the aftermath of the assassination, but also the trial of Jack Ruby, who shot Lee Harvey Oswald even while he was awaiting trial for the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Uwe Simonetto is a regular guest. He's an international journalist. He's a resident scholar and director of the New Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and director of the Concordia Center on Religion and the Media for Concordia University in Bronxville, New York. Uwe, welcome back.
Good evening again.
Where were you when you heard the news about John F. Kennedy being shot in Dallas?
I was in New York City. I had just arrived about a year earlier as a foreign correspondent for German newspapers. That Friday was my day off, and I was goofing off in my living room when a friend of ours telephoned us and said, switch on CBS, which I didn't. I saw Walter Cronkite there in tears announcing Kennedy's assassination.
So how did you get from your living room on your day off, hearing the news that virtually the whole world heard that afternoon from Dallas, Texas, to Dallas, Texas, and covering the trial and the events that transpired in between?
First, of course, I got quickly showered and dressed and did what a good journalist would do. Get a reaction piece. Of course, my colleagues in the office were doing the running story. I hopped the cab. I couldn't even telephone them because they wouldn't pick up the phone. So I hopped the cab and drove up to Harlem to various churches to do a sidebar, especially how the black population of New York City and other groups reacted to the assassination news, and then went back to the office, wrote my piece, wrote a weekender for one of Germany's leading Sunday papers, Bild am Sonntag, and then drove to Washington because, of course, all the world leaders were on their way to Washington, Charles de Gaulle, Konrad Adenauer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then from Washington, I was in the State Department, actually, when the news broke Jack Ruby had shot Lee Harvey Oswald in the basement or in the garage of the police headquarters in Dallas, and I hopped the plane down to Dallas and covered the story from there.
When you got to Dallas on the beginning of that week after the president's assassination, what did you do first? I mean, where do you go when you got this, basically the story of a lifetime? You're covering it for the European press. And where do you
Well, the first place, obviously, I went to was, because it was still the same day when Ruby had shot Oswald. So I went to the police headquarters, checked out the area for a colorful story of this thing. Then the next day, I tried to get into Ruby's bar. He had a strip joint called the Carousel Burlesque Lounge, which was at first closed, but pretty soon opened again. And then I talked to the strippers there who told me a great deal about Jack Ruby's personality, They were interesting people. I mean, you went to this bar, you had to brown back your booze because this carousel burlesque bar was in a dry part of Dallas. So you brown back your booze, you had a stripper, and one lady was 28 and had five children. She was one of the strippers. Then they sit next to you and they give you ice and soda water for your whiskey. And she became actually a very, very interesting source of information about Jack Ruby and the personality he was, and maybe some insights as to why he might have shot Lee Harvey Oswald. And then, of course, I went to the Dallas Morning News, the local newspapers. The usual thing you do in a big news event like that, you check in with the local your local colleagues, and of course any source you can get. District attorney. The district attorney at the time was Henry Wade, curiously. That is the Wade of Roe versus Wade, or who would become 5 years later the, not 5 years later, but...
About a decade later.
A decade later, exactly a decade later, the Wade of Roe versus Wade, and with whom I became very, very friendly 25 years after the Jack Ruby trial. And he told me amazing stuff about himself. I mean, he was a hard-nosed prosecutor, but who brought the gospel to the condemned to the death cells. And a very interesting man.
What did you, before we get to the trial of Jack Ruby, what did you learn about Jack Ruby from talking about the people who worked for him at his burlesque bar?
Well, Jack Ruby... Let me first describe the character, and then you'll see what Jack Ruby came from the Jewish ghettos around Chicago. He was a little man, not a very pretty guy, but a friendly guy who liked to make friends and liked to be loved and wanted to be loved. He was awfully nice, for example, to those strippers. He treated them extremely well. He got on extremely well with the cops. He loved to look up to his big, tall Texans, sent sandwiches out to the cops, invited them. They could come to a strip joint for free. He would feed them booze. He wanted to be one of the boys. And I believe that is one of the clues, that is probably the clue as to why he eventually murdered, because it was indeed murder, Lee Harvey Oswald. And that was, of course, also the defense's argument, which I buy into and bought into at the time, that he wanted to be accepted. He, the little guy from the suburbs of Chicago, from the ghettos of Chicago, came down to where the big boys are with the big guns at the, in their holsters, and he wanted to be accepted by them. And they talked big, and he acted the way they talked.
And so just to kind of fill in the last piece of the puzzle there with regard to Ruby before we talk about his trial, make it clear, why do you think, in your journalist's perspective, why do you think he decided that he had to kill Lee Harvey Oswald after Oswald was accused of assassinating
Because Lee Harvey Oswald brought shame on Dallas. And Ruby identified or wanted to be seen as somebody who identified with Dallas. He didn't want shame to be brought into Dallas. And, you know, these guys, you know how Texans are. They talk big. His son of a bitch, he should be killed, you know, something like that.
You're or talking to talk, a Texan, by the way.
Thank God, then you probably know what I'm talking about.
I know
about.
Exactly what you're talking about.
So they talk big, but of course they don't go around shoot everybody. but this little bugger, of course, felt that it would impress the big Texans if he shot Louis. I don't think there has been a conspiracy of any sort in the killing of Lee Harvey Oswald. It's another deal when we go discuss Lee Harvey Oswald. There, I think there is a lot of wobbly and very fishy stuff that that has not come to the forefront yet, and I can give you some theories on it. Only speculation, because you won't find anything of that in the Warren Report, and by the way, you shouldn't either.
So, to put it in a nutshell with regard to Jack Ruby, he wanted to be a hero. And he believed he would be a hero.
Hero. He wanted to be respected, accepted, well-liked by the guys who talked big. Folks, it's a psychological problem, you know.
Folks, we'll take your phone calls for the next half hour on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Today marks the 42nd anniversary of that event. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Uwe C. Minetto is our guest, and we're coming to you live this Tuesday, November the 22nd, here in the last 45 minutes of Issues Etc. today. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Tell us about the Jack Ruby trial.
Well, the Jack Ruby trial was one of the most amazing situations. I've covered several trials before, but I've never seen anything like it. I mean, here's this old-fashioned Texan courthouse. You had Henry Wade in his cowboy boots, which were at the table in front of him, chewing cigars and spitting into his spittoon. You know, to us Europeans, this was an unusual sight, to say the least, at least in life. Of course, we see this sort of thing in films, but not really. Then you had, on the other side, Melvin Belli, in an immaculately tailored Savile Row suit, pink lined, if you don't mind, flapping about.
Ruby's attorney.
Ruby's attorney. He was the defense attorney. Then you had Judge Joe Brown, who had a very small head, I remember, and had a ventilator under his desk, which blew up his robe, so he had this huge, big black ball with a tiny head on top of it, and I'm quite sure the guy was asleep most of the time. And then next to me, and then you had all the world's press and everybody else, and then the press, but next to me was what you Americans call a veritable bimbo. I mean, so I'd never seen something like that, and certainly she didn't look like a news hen, certainly not of that period of time. Heavily perfumed and heavily made up. And I sort of looked at her. She said next to me, I said, what newspaper would you, might you be representing here? And she said, no, I'm not. I'm a California judge or magistrate. I'm representing, some counties, judges or magistrates association. Orange County, I believe it was. It then turned out, of course, that she was very much linked to Melvin Belli, who happened to be my neighbor in the Hilton Hotel in Dallas, and so I knew all the nasty details there. So that was the scene. And then you had this extraordinary parade of strippers with funny names testifying on behalf of Jack Ruby. And somehow, I don't know, most of us journalists at the time, at least the foreigners, empathized with Jack Ruby because we didn't have the feeling that he was a mean murderer. We just thought he was an idiot killer. And it turned out to be more and more that way. Whereas at the outside the courtroom, you had Lee Harvey Oswald's mother trying to tap all us foreign correspondents for lots of money and saying she would only talk to us for lots of... This was pre-checkbook journalism. That's where it started. You know, normally we weren't allowed to pay for it, and I certainly refused to pay for any interview. But she flapped about and tried to sell her late son, as some kind of a hero. And then, of course, there was Marina, his widow, who was quite demure, and I can't recall that she spoke English all that well because she was a Bielorussian girl. And he, of course, had lived in Minsk for a long time as a member of the Communist Party. Let's not forget that.
So outside the courtroom, Oswald's mother trying to solicit...
Hustled.
You're trying to hustle reporters for a few bucks to tell her story.
She hasn't stopped. I think, God knows how many decades later, I contacted her again. She still tried to hustle me for money. I mean, that is, this was to me such an alien culture, which has since become familiar because Margaret Oswald was her name. The Margaret Oswald had become a paradigm of modern communications consumers or media consumers. You know, if you want a story, you pay me. my son is a murderer, never mind. If you want to hear about it, you pay me. And, of course, until then, nobody would pay her, at least not any big bucks. By now, things have changed considerably, alas.
Even though Oswald was shot and dead by the time you arrived in Dallas, what was your assessment, from a reporter's standpoint, of Lee Harvey Oswald?
Okay. My assessment, and I must say, I mean, I have no proof of this. I am like everybody else, bound by what we find in the Warren Report, which is on record. But my assessment was this. Ruby had been a communist, an ex-Marine, committed communist, went to the Soviet Union, lived in Belorussian. Even the Russians thought he was a bit nuts, but, I mean, that's another thing. He was a sharpshooter within the Marines. Later that was talked down that he wasn't such a good sharpshooter. Nevertheless, he was a very good sharpshooter. And he had been to Cuba, and he had very rich contacts with Cuba and other communist movements while in Mexico and elsewhere. Remember that this happened historically after Kennedy had forced Khrushchev, the Soviet Communist Party leader at the time, to back down in the Cuban Missile Crisis, which, by the way, was the event that brought me to America in the first place, the Cuban Missile Crisis of the fall of 1962.
Just for our listeners who hear Cuban Missile Crisis, and for them that is a phrase, a brief explanation of what happened during that Soviet buildup in the Cuban islands and the embargo and Kennedy's stand-down.
The Soviet Union had brought missiles, long-range missiles, that could hit any target along the east coast of the United States, in place in Cuba. And America insisted that they be brought back, be taken back, taken out of there. And there was an embargo of Cuba, and it came to the point, we now know how close we were to World War III, it came to the point that no side was willing to back down, seemingly so, and there could have been an exchange. I mean, there was the distinct possibility that the United States would have tried to knock out these Soviet missiles, and there would have been retaliation. Anyway, in the end, Kennedy succeeded in staring down Khrushchev. Khrushchev had to take those missiles out. It was a major political and psychological defeat for the Soviet bloc, not only for the Soviet Union, but also, of course, for specifically for Fidel Castro. As within months of, if you will, the communist defeat in this psychological form of warfare, Kennedy was killed by a guy who had been a communist party member, had been in exile in the Soviet Union, and had very close links to Cuba. It wasn't fashionable in the 1960s to say that the communists were the bad guys, or it became less and less fashionable with the liberal left at the time. It was much more fashionable to say that Kennedy might have been shot in a conspiracy by right-wing extremists in Dallas who didn't like Kennedy's policies on the civil rights front, for example, which did not strike me as particularly convincing, but many Europeans speculated along those lines, specifically the French and the Italian press, even some German journalists and British journalists, even some Americans for that matter. I don't believe this to be the case. If there's been any conspiracy at all, again, I have no proof of this, it's a simple conjecture here. If there's been any form of conspiracy, and not just a freak occurrence, you would have to lay the blame at Moscow's and Cuba's feet. However, if this is so, and I'm quite sure the 30 years from now or whenever the spooks are allowed to release their documents, you will probably find that there would have been good reason to keep this quiet, because if it had come out, in 1963 that